Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to another Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This podcast contains part two of my interview with Christopher Devine on his research on the electoral effects of vice presidential candidates. In the second part of this interview, we delve into his new book, which looks for and, in fact, does find some electoral effects for vice presidential candidates at the national level, moving beyond his earlier work focused on the state level. Thanks for listening. So let's talk about the new book available. Do Running Mates Matter? The Influence of Vice Presidential Candidates in Presidential Elections. This sort of looks at the whole big picture, all 50 states, rather than just focusing on the home state. This is out, what, last week, I think? It's the official date available for purchase on Amazon now. We'll have the link, and other booksellers as well. We'll have a link up for you.
Thank you.
I noticed, now I haven't, bad interviewer, I have not had a chance to actually peruse the book in much detail. I was looking around on Amazon search inside the book a little bit. And I noticed, I'll ask you first about this. You open with a couple of chapters on perception, right? Because the finding of your first book, and I imagine to a significant extent this book as well, that we don't really have much evidence that this matters, runs counter to what a lot of people think. And so you have a chapter on why presidential candidates think running mates matter and why voters do. So maybe say a little bit about that. I'm curious about that. I didn't realize your research was on this subject was extending into that. What are some of your conclusions there?
Yeah, that's a fun part of the book too. Again, there's where we get to do some historical research. So if you're someone who's not as fond of the statistical elements of it, part one is going to be your home, I think, in the book. I'm not saying you specifically, anyone who would feel that way. We get into some historical archives and things like that. And really what we're trying to do in part one of the book is, if we're writing a book that the main focus, it is usually the part that I'm talking about, part two, is what effect do they actually have? We'll talk about the three ways in which they could have those effects, I'm sure. But before we even get to that conversation, just as authors on this, we felt like, don't we have to justify this is even a question worth tackling? Like, do we know that, for instance, this has any influence in the actual selection process? Or for that matter, do we know that, voters go along with this idea that the running mate matters? Would they admit, or would they say at least that it matters to them? And so the first chapter of the book is looking at, whether and if so, how presidential candidates think that running mates matter electorally speaking. And the second chapter is doing the same, but just for voters using available polling data. So short version, what we find in terms of presidential candidates, they always say, of course, and you hear this from Joe Biden as well, hey, all I'm looking to do is find someone who could be president take over as president if something happened to me. On day one, they're ready to go. Well, as we know from looking at history, it doesn't always turn out that way. And you can come up with your own favorite example on this one, right? So what else are they considering? So, a lot of times they'll say also there should be some kind of compatibility, usually in terms of politics, similar ideology or views on a specific issue. They might mention personal compatibility as well, which makes a lot of sense. This is someone that could be a good partner on the campaign trail, a good partner in the White House. Sometimes they'll throw in, hey, as a bonus, it'd be nice if they helped me in the election, but they usually shy away from saying that. When you look at what they say privately, so if we can go back years later and look at their own accounts of that process, or campaign insiders, their accounts, someone like, let's say, David Axelrod or David Plouffe, for instance, later on, what do they say? That's when you get the things they can't say during the campaign. So in other words, if they were going to say that electoral considerations were involved, of course they wouldn't announce it to the public. Oh yeah, we're also trying to pick someone for this important position who can just, help me win an election. No, they don't say that. But do they are they saying at the time, or do they admit it later? I wouldn't overstate this. Don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that, hey, when you get into the secret archives, you find out that all along it was strictly about winning an election. No, no, no. In fact, if you look at recent history, I think most vice presidential candidates, whatever you think of their politics left or right, at least in terms of qualifications, have been plausible, if not entirely credible, vice presidents. But anyway, in that process, what you often see is there's at least the allowance for the possibility. It, in some cases, it seems to actually be driving the process. In other cases, it's a factor that they don't end up going with. But in every case, I'd say, you see at least some indication, if not a strong one, that they're giving credence to the idea that this choice could really help me win the election. It might bring in this group of voters, for instance. And my favorite example of this, just quickly, is Gerald Ford in 1976, who you know, this is kind of the beginning of the modern vice presidency period. Jimmy Carter is really redefining the vice presidential search. Ford's kind of lagging behind, but still saying a lot of the right things. You know, I'm picking someone who's going to be president on day one, or, you know, take over if necessary, and so on. And also some compatibility and maybe election if I, you know, electoral bonus if I can help it would be great, but that's an afterthought. That's pretty much what he was saying. Go back to this. I went to the Ford archives in Ann Arbor, and there's an interview that he did in 1990. So politics is well in the past for him. And he says, picking Bob Dole in 1976, of course, he dumped Nelson Rockefeller, who was very unpopular with conservatives and the Reagan faction. He says picking Bob Dole was a purely pragmatic political decision, or something to that effect. Just outright says this was to win the election. He thought Dole would help him in the Midwest, especially with farmers, might help him with veterans and so on. I'm not saying that's the usual, but there are pronounced cases like that where you go behind the curtain and you find out that actually, you know, contrary to what they were saying in public, these were huge considerations. I even found a memo that it wasn't clear who it was from, but it's probably from Dick Cheney, who was heading the vice presidential search, which would be ironic.
Yeah,
And it's what they're looking for in a running mate. And it barely mentions, I think there's one line where it mentions qualifications. It's all about, you know, winning a swing state, winning over this group of voters, good campaigner, all that kind of stuff.
All right. Good. And what about voters? Let's say something about maybe, obviously, I think there's it seems to me there's a general perception that vice presidents matter in a variety of ways. I guess what voters think is different than what the sort of chatter you hear on political Twitter suggests people think. But what are some of your findings there?
Sure. So among voters, we try to tackle this in a comprehensive way by really pulling together a lot of the literature. So there have been studies done in the past, never really a comprehensive one on running mate's electoral effect. There's been, you know, like our research in the past had just been on geography. And there was a much longer literature on that. There's a little bit on demographic effects, you know, on how they affect Catholic voters, or a little bit on women running mates in the past for our own Palin, but just kind of pieces here and there. And so we're trying to pull a lot of things together and think about, okay, what are all the ways that a running mate could affect the voters? And the first one would be the most obvious one, what we call direct effects. So that's just, you know, hey, does your evaluation of the vice presidential candidate directly affect how you vote? I like the running mate better. I like the running mate, you know, not as well. That's going to affect the probability of me voting for that ticket. The second pathway, as we describe it, it would be targeted effects. And this is probably the one you hear the most about, which is, hey, if you pick this candidate, you'll pick up this group of voters. You'll deliver this group of voters, which, again, often is in geographic terms. But also in terms of demographics, or even in terms of ideology, which, as I was mentioning, can be a social group in itself, really. Do those targeted effects happen? Do you deliver those groups of voters? Well, in those first two cases, we find pretty limited evidence of that, quite limited. I wouldn't say no evidence. I wouldn't overstate it and say, no, they don't matter in those ways. But it's not a whole lot. So in terms of direct effects, the presidential candidate matters a whole lot more, how you evaluate that person. We see some pretty small effects for what you think of the running mate, just in general, in terms of how people vote, which, you know, partly goes along with the idea naturally, especially with, you know, the increasing importance, I'd say, of partisanship, it's going to tend to be that if you prefer, you know, Donald Trump, you're also going to prefer Mike Pence to the Democratic option, right? And vice right. versa. So those aren't going to diverge a whole lot. But, you know, to the extent that they do, what effect does that have? One interesting way we get at that, by the way, is it's a pretty advanced method here, vector autoregression, where you can test dynamic relationships over time. We're using rolling cross-sectional data in this case from the 2000-2004 National Annenberg election studies. So you can actually see if there was a spike in Dick Cheney or John Edwards' favorability, how long did that, or shock, as we call it in these terms, how long did that shock last in terms of changing people's perceptions about the presidential candidate and how they voted as well. And in most cases, if there's a bump in the running mate's popularity, it goes away almost immediately. There's no lasting effect. We actually did find one for Edwards, which is kind of funny in retrospect, right?
That'd be wild, yeah.
Not your first choice of a great selection, but he was relatively popular at the time.
Right.
So that can happen, but it's rare. In terms of targeted effects, you know, I should stipulate first that we can only work with the historical facts that we have. Okay, so I cannot tell you, if Joe Biden were to choose an African American running mate or Latino running mate, what effect would that have? I can only speculate based on the evidence we have available. But it's pretty underwhelming, you know, compared to what you might expect. So of course we all know that Mike Pence delivered evangelicals and conservatives and maybe even Midwesterners in 2016, right?
Right.
No, actually, that's not clear. This is the best evidence we have of this. You could say the same for Sarah Palin and women in 2008, or Joe Biden and Catholics in 2008, or Tim Kaine and Southerners or Catholics in 2016, and so on. In each of these years, we're actually able to get our hands on panel data. So this is survey data where the respondents are being interviewed continuously at points throughout the campaign. So we're not switching from this sample to that sample. We're looking at the same people over time. And so capitalizing on some really excellent research by Gabriel Lenz kind of testing panel data multiple waves, we can see, if you were to control for, let's say, I'll use the Palin example. That's the most interesting one, I think. But again, it goes the same for, you know, Pence and evangelicals and so on. If you were to see what was the effect of gender on intended vote choice in 2008 before Palin was selected. Mm-hmm. So in June of 2008, you know, she selected August 29th, very late. If you were to control for those pre-existing preferences, and then at a later stage in the campaign, September, October, November, even when the election's done, one of your control variables in the equation is previous, preferences, electoral preferences.
Right.
Does, in that case, gender have an effect on how you plan to vote or how you did vote, independent of controlling for how you were planning to vote already before she was selected?
Right.
So we can see, did women become increasingly likely to vote for the Republican ticket after Palin was selected? And we find they did not. We find some temporary effects, for instance, temporarily, just for a blip. Palin, it's hard to attribute it to her, but again, was there a change in evangelicals' behavior or conservatives' behavior intended after she was selected? There was a temporary increase in their willingness to vote for the ticket, but that faded out by the end of the campaign. So just to pull all that together, that's just a sampling of some of the evidence. There's a lot more in there as well. We find, by and large, there's not much in the way of a geographic or demographic or ideological effects. The one exception being that using a similar test to what I was just describing, we did find that Paul Ryan, his selection probably helped Mitt Romney with conservatives. There was a significant increase controlling for pre-existing preferences. There was a significant increase in conservatives being willing to vote for Romney Ryan after Ryan's selection in August that year. So, sorry, you know, it's going on a while, but summarizing the whole book here.
That's interesting because I might have just speculated, that if somebody recently was going to have that kind of an effect, Pence might have been the one I would have guessed, right? Because I sort of his sort of calming effect for institutionalists, if you will, right? Seems like a kind of thing, but I can certainly see how that might have been the case for Ryan as well. That makes a certain amount of sense.
Right. Let me just say on that, if I can, you know, there are some things we can show directly and some things we can only, you know,
right,
speculate in an informed way based on the evidence. In my right. informed speculation, but not direct causal summary here, would be, you know, I think like a lot of things in politics, you can see this in terms of debate performances and things like that. You know, Sides of Average show this really well in the gamble with the effect of the first debate in 2012, where, you know, Barack Obama kind of, you know, just didn't have a good performance and, you know, what effect did they have on the race? What we often see is that vice presidential pick, debate, whatever it is, it may not be that it's actually changing the eventual outcome someone was going to have. What it can often function as an event like this, VP selection, whatever, it's an excuse to return home, as I see it.
Right,
you know,
right.
So for all, you know, evangelicals or conservatives, others in the party who might have said, oh, I don't know if I can vote for Donald Trump. There's this issue. There's that issue. In the end, were they really going to vote for Hillary Clinton? Those right. same folks, you know, my speculation would be that by and large, I don't think this was consciously, it's probably subconsciously, but it was happening that in their minds, they were looking for an excuse to justify voting for Donald Trump in the end anyway. And exactly. Mike Pence provided a convenient excuse. I've heard a lot of people, even just person-to-person conversations saying, you know, I wasn't going to vote for Trump, but then he picked Mike Pence and that's what did it for me. And I don't know. It's yeah. a nice story yeah. and they might even believe it, but I think by and large, those people were never going to vote for Hillary Clinton or stay home in the end anyway.
So another way of putting it would be, you know, we live in this era of very heightened and strong polarization, and most of us don't want to admit the effects that that polarization has on us.
Yeah.
Right? That we're, you know, which is why I think you're going to, you know, my informed speculation is that we're going to see a lot of the same thing with, you know, some of the left flank of voters who'd say Biden is, you know, too centrist, I'm not going to vote for him. You know, and obviously some of the louder, more media people will follow through on that thread. But voters in general, I think, are going to experience something similar. And they'll have some story they'll tell in 2021 about what caused them to come around. And that's just a kind of a story they tell themselves more than an accurate description of their motivations. That's my, you know, so that makes a lot of sense. Of course, it adds another wrinkle into trying to study this, right? The voters themselves are not reliable narrators of their own decision-making processes, even if we do take them to be more or less reliable narrators of their own commitments and ideology. Their actual decision-making processes, maybe there's less reason to do so.
Right. And you know, there isn't, I think we're all susceptible to that. Let's be honest.
Of course.
The literature shows us very, very well. It's kind of a natural process. And that's why I say, you know, people might even believe that this was what made the difference. But to your point about the unreliable narrator, that's a good way of putting it. That's why we use things like, the vector autoregression, where we can track the effect of changes over time. That's right. why we use the panel data, where instead of going back to people and saying to them, hey, you know, did the running mate change your mind? And they might want to say yes or no, want to cite Pence, for instance. You know, when you track those voters over the course of the campaign, you're not seeing those effects. So that's why we're trying to capitalize on really the timing issues in the data where we can. And by the way, I should mention, you were asking, sorry, I didn't really get to chapter two. I talked about chapter one so much. You were asking too about what do voters think about whether running mates matter. If you ask them directly, hey, is Joe Biden's choice of a running mate going to matter? It's actually incredibly consistent over the years. 80%+ will tell you this is important, really important, or pretty important, or something like that. They'll say this matters to me. And even, hey, if he chose Elizabeth Warren, you know, or if he chose Kamala Harris, you know, would that make you more likely? You get large percentages that say they do. of course, you're prompting them to think about it. You're exactly. cueing them and just asking the question to think, well, maybe this should be related to how I vote. Well, what's a good alternative to that? The ANES for a number of years, they haven't done it recently, but for a number of years, I think it was 68 to 2004, they asked people, you know, what caused you to like or dislike the presidential candidate in this year? And just let them bring it up unprompted. Percentage of people who mention, and it has several codes for this, who mention the running mate in any way is minuscule. Sometimes it is in the low, low single digits. You can see there's a chart on this in chapter two, if you're interested. There's a spike for Geraldine Ferraro, actually 84, who got the most comments, but they're actually slightly more negative than positive. But people unprompted, just bringing it up on their own, what made you vote for this candidate or that candidate? They'll tell you in advance if you ask them that it'll matter a lot. You ask them afterwards without prompting, they'll almost never bring up the running mate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. All right. Maybe you, I was kind of trying to poke around for it, but I didn't find it on the, just like with the limited ability to play around with your book on via Amazon.
I should have got you a copy in advance. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine.
Been quite a week.
But I know there's a, so I, you know, I think you, it may not surprise you to learn that the search inside the book function comes up with something like 77 entries for Sarah Palin. She shows up quite a bit in your book. I know there's a paper, and this is, I should have thought about this beforehand and looked it up, but there's, I think Scott's blogged about it before, that showed that Palin is kind of the exception to the rule and that she did matter, but she had a negative effect on the Republican vote share in 2008. Do you kind of engage with that paper at all? Do you know what paper I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's a couple that kind of get, and some of them are for overall electorate. Some of them focus on you know, certain, I forget if it's by party or ideology, maybe both. So they slice up the electorate in some different ways. It gets into how hard it is to measure this. That's why we try to do it from a lot of different angles. So those studies are dependent on one methodology, which, you know, I think are pretty good, but there are some things that, some reasons why I think you would want to test in multiple ways. We don't give a precise estimate on what her effect was overall. You know, when you do, gets a book, or anybody gets to read this in depth, you see chapter five is really where we get to this the most. And there's a whole lot of data going on. We weren't able to get to everything as thoroughly as we'd like. We kind of try to focus on the big picture as much as we can. I don't have a precise estimate on that. But where I think I can speak best to her effect, and I should mention, you know, yeah, Palin comes up a lot. Biden comes up a lot. They're on the cover. They're really the stars of this book. Not so much by our choice as the fact that, you know, when you get into using surveys to study the effects of running mates, not a lot of surveys actually directly ask things, have as specific measures about the running mate, or if they do, it's a pretty limited one, like what's your overall opinion, favorability, and that's it. It just so happens, fortuitously, I think some of this was by coincidence, because some of them were, you know, panel surveys that started before Palin's selection. But it just so happened that in 2008, we get by far the best data, things asking specifically about how ready is this person to be president, for example, which of course was the big issue with Palin, but also different, you know, attributes of John McCain or Barack Obama, like is this person for McCain too old to be president or Obama too young to be president? What about their ideology and things like that? So it just so happens, not by our choice, but just by, you know, kind of a nice coincidence, that by far the best data available out there in surveys comes from 2008. Mm. So, you know, and this gets to where we test the indirect effects. And sorry, I got so caught up in the first two, the direct and target, I didn't really describe this, but this is actually the big takeaway from the book.
Good.
Is, you know, as I said, there are some direct effects, your evaluation of the running mate affecting directly how you vote. There are some targeted effects, very, very little, according to our research, but we do find one for Paul Ryan and in terms of conservatives, and we find some temporary bumps with certain groups, but ones that didn't last for in other cases. The clearest effect is what we call an indirect effect, and that is what you think of the running mate changes what you think of the presidential candidate. And that, in turn, is the indirect part, has an effect on how you vote. In fact, with the most comprehensive ways that we can test this in the chapter, this chapter five, we can show that the size of the indirect effect is greater than the size of the indirect effect is greater than the size, the magnitude of the direct effect. In other words, what you think of Sarah Palin in terms of her readiness to be president is going to directly affect how you vote. Oh, I don't know if I want to elect a less qualified, less ready to be president, vice president.
Right.
Or I do want to elect Joe Biden because he's, you know, vice president. He'd be a good one because he's more experienced or something like that. Right. At the same time, though, it's also affecting what you think of John McCain or think of Barack Obama. And that's also going to affect how you vote. So what we can show, and this is where we use structural equation models. So again, we have a lot of different methods going on here, a lot of different data sources. This is not dependent on one approach. We really tackle it from a lot of different angles. But we can show directly that your perception of Palin's or Biden's readiness to be president is how the survey question was phrased. That has an effect directly on a variety of things we can demonstrate, including John McCain's judgment or Barack Obama's judgment. So if you think worse of Palin's readiness to be president, you also think worse of McCain's judgment.
Right.
And that's going to make you less likely to vote for McCain, you know, and vice versa. Of course, it works both ways. Some people are going to think she is qualified. Some are going to think Biden's not, maybe for partisan reasons or whatever it may be. But obviously, by and large, there was a tendency more to see Biden's qualified, Palin's less qualified. So our inference from that is these indirect effects probably did hurt, although we don't specifically quantify, but probably did hurt John McCain in 2008 and probably helped Barack Obama.
Yeah, that's interesting. So maybe what are some other maybe examples of where you find some real indirect effects, some potentially ones of noticeable magnitude?
Sure. So those are I'd say the most direct ones. First of all, going beyond 2008, so we can actually use ANES measures again. They do consistently for a number of years ask, what's your favorability of the running mate? You know, how would you rate them on feeling thermometers in this case? So 0 to 100, 0 is the coldest, most negative opinion, 100 is the warmest, most positive. So you can actually, you know, test out the relationship between those two things, although that's happening at snapshot in time. This is why we also like to use the dynamic data, the rolling cross-sectional or the panel. But in this case, we're restricted to the cross-sectional snapshot. So we can use data from a number of years just to show as a general matter, not specific to just 2008 and Palin and Biden, but as a general matter, people's favorability toward the running mate, as I say, directly affects the favorability towards a presidential candidate, and that directly affects willingness to vote for that candidate. And that effect, that indirect effect is about, it actually varies by party, but I think it's like 2 to 3 for a Republican, or 2.3 to 1 for Republicans, the ratio, and 5.7 to 1 for Democrats. That indirect effect is greater than the direct effect. In other words, that the running mate opinion, your opinion of the running mate, its eventual effect on the vote is much greater in terms of how it shapes your opinion of the presidential candidate than it is just directly people saying, "Oh wow, I wouldn't want that person to be vice president of the United States." We also show, although in this case, we, because of data limitations, we can't directly link it to vote choice, but we do show, and I think this would be a lot of interest to you, especially for the 2020 conversation, that running mates shape perceptions of the presidential candidate's ideology. So to give you a concrete example, in 2008, controlling for other factors, if you thought that Joe Biden was very liberal, the predicted probability of you saying that Barack Obama was very liberal was about, I think, 60%. If you thought Joe Biden was a moderate, the predicted probability that you thought Barack Obama was very liberal, okay, same outcome, but we've shifted Joe Biden's ideological perception. Perception of Barack Obama being very liberal goes down from 60% to about 15%.
Wow.
That's a dramatic change.
Yeah.
And for a point of comparison, that'll also be relevant to 2020.
Yeah,
we saw about half that effect, still a substantial one, but about half that effect for John McCain. So if you thought that Sarah Palin was very conservative, 30% probability that you thought John McCain was very conservative. Now shift Sarah Palin's perception by way of predicted probabilities. If she was perceived as moderate, now there's an 8% chance that you think that John McCain is very conservative.
So that's 22. Fascinating.
And I think why that is, and this is worth keeping in mind for 2020, again, yeah. I can only speculate based on the available evidence. Why might that be? Well, Barack Obama compared to John McCain was much less known quantity. There was a lot more room to shape. And I think even to this day, if you were to ask people, hey, Barack Obama, progressive or moderate or kind of Joe Biden type, like median Democrat versus, well to the left, that's going to shift a lot. Like different people are going to have different answers to that.
Yeah.
John McCain was much better known. I think there's less room to shift perception of who he is. So if Donald Trump, he's not going to do this, I don't think, but if he were to dump Mike Pence and pick someone else, that could move perceptions of his ideology, signal which way he's going, moderate or conservative. But there's only so much you can do to change perceptions of Donald Trump's ideology. And for Joe Biden as well, very well known, probably less room to change opinions of him. But I do think that's meaningful and a worthy consideration for him. He could probably shade opinion of his ideology one direction or another. If he chooses Elizabeth Warren, for example, I think there are a lot of people who are going to say, much like they probably did for John McCain, although on the flip side of this, but for Joe Biden, they might say, oh, wow, I guess he's more progressive than I thought he was. Mm-hmm. Or at least if he's not really, that he's going to behave that way when he's in office. Like he seems to be signaling that he's going to not take progressive for granted and see that they're a necessary part of the coalition and he needs to, throw them some bones to carry them along. Whereas if he, and this is probably analogous to Hillary Clinton in 2016, if Biden were being perceived as a relative centrist within the party to choose someone who's also a relative centrist within the party, think Amy Klobuchar, probably that's going to have some people on the left saying, see, I told you that's who this guy is, and he thinks he can take us for granted.
Hmm. Now, here's the tricky thing. This is interesting because, now we've kind of zeroed in on where the evidence for effect really seems to be showing up. But then there's the sort of question of the difficulty of knowing how this change in perception is actually going to play out. Right. So one could go into 2008 and think, well, maybe McCain is picking Palin to shore up people's views on him as either a robust movement conservative or to maybe youth and vigor perception on him.
Yeah.
And what happens is not that, right? It ends up tainting people's sense of his judgment, which should have been based on his reputation prior to 2008, one of his strengths. It seems to me we may be shaping up for something, a similar sort of conundrum for Biden, right? Is maybe if this works as your research suggests it would, and Elizabeth Warren sort of signals to progressives, no, he's really going to be one of us. But then that signal might hurt him with other audiences, right? So it's tricky to know. Even if we've isolated the effect, it's tricky to know the direction it's going to go, right? So, how would you? Let's lean into this a little bit more. If you're advising Biden campaign right now, how would you think about this? And let's say they tell you, "Help us win the election. We don't care about who would be a good president." You're being called in to advise on.
Yep.
The best you can do to win the election. How would you encourage him to think about that?
So the first thing I'd say is that it's a false choice to say that and you're not getting at this at all, but I know this conversation is out there. It's a false choice to say that you have to choose between someone who can help in the campaign and help you in the White House. If there's one clear takeaway from our research, it's that people expect and demand a qualified running mate. Not necessarily because they're just amazed by the awesome power of the vice presidency and really want someone who can, cast a good vote, tie-breaking vote in the Senate or something like that. Although vice presidents do play, a really important role these days in terms of being congressional liaisons and foreign policy liaisons and so on. But it's a signal that you're taking this thing seriously. You're making decisions for the right reasons. This is often called the first presidential act. if you make some kind of obvious electoral gamble, like John McCain did in 2008, you know, clearly you didn't survey the field and say, yep, this is the person who's most ready to be the president of the United States if something happens to me. You know, people see through that, and I think it's really going to undercut perceptions of you, especially in the case of someone like McCain or even like Biden, where experience is your strength. You don't want to undercut that. Mm-hmm. And especially when, you know, if you're expecting, like McCain did, a game changer, this is really going to change the fundamental dynamics of the race. That's just expecting too much. Mm-hmm. So people do expect a qualified running mate. They say this in polls, by the way, when you ask them about what's important, they'll say that qualifications matter most. But in this case, we actually see that borne out by the data that, you know, perceptions of readiness affect perceptions of the presidential candidate really across a wide range of attributes, including some of the ones that I mentioned, but also some others. So you really do need to pick someone who's qualified. That's the starting point. Like anybody who doesn't clearly meet that test, it should be thrown out. And I should mention qualifications. You know, when you see this debate, for instance, most starkly, I would say with Stacey Abrams, potential, candidacy. And what I see a lot of people saying, and not to focus on her, you can say this about other candidates who are in the mix, but, you know, just as a broader conversation, who will say, yeah, but actually, you know, you're thinking about experience the wrong way. You know, this also should count. And that's fine, but just notice you're building in the idea that Biden's going to have to take time to make that case. He might be able to persuade people, but anybody who he picks as his running mate and then has to persuade Americans that this person, even if they have a good case, if you can make it, if you have to persuade them that they can be a good vice president and even a president if necessary, I think that's a problem in itself. Right. It's best to pick someone who is immediately perceived as qualified, and that's the key. So much of our research is about perception. So you might be right that Stacey Abrams is perfectly well qualified, or I don't know, whoever, Gretchen Whitmer or someone like that. Fine. But we can also look at someone like Kamala Harris, who doesn't have, you know, drastically more experience than some of those other people in the mix, like Gretchen Whitmer or Catherine Cortez Masto or Michelle Lujan Grisham and so on. But my take on it, my read, I could be wrong, but I think this is true, is that she would be more immediately perceived as qualified if only because she was on that stage auditioning for the presidency for a number of months. Yes, it was, you know, a problematic campaign in a lot of ways, but I think she would be more immediately seen as qualified than a lot of these other names that are being put out there. So I think it's important to focus on qualifications and perceptions in particular. Even when it comes to something like ideology, you know, some of the potential running mates are clearly perceived as being one camp or the other. You know, Amy Klobuchar, I don't think there's any debate that, you know, by and large, she is seen as a relative moderate in the Democratic Party. Elizabeth Warren, relative progressive. I don't think you're going to have a lot of people, you know, flipping the other way on those ones. Someone like Harris, and I think you could say this about other people, Tammy Baldwin comes to mind, or even some of the others that I mentioned, I think you get more of a range of answers, and that leaves some ambiguity to convince people that, you know, she is whoever you want her to be.
Yeah.
Again, that idea that people want to come home. You know, if you're a moderate, it's hard to persuade yourself that Elizabeth Warren's actually a moderate and this is a win for us, or vice versa for Klobuchar and progressives. Someone like Harris or Baldwin or, you know, again, others you could throw out there. I think there's some room for people to persuade themselves, if only because of it's convenient that, you know, oh, good. You know, this is more from my wing of the party.
Right. Right. And it's easy for us political scientists to sit back and say, well, you know, partisanship will do its work eventually. How they get persuaded doesn't matter. But if you're running a campaign, it's kind of your job to not sit back and wait for it to happen, right? You need to make sure it happens. So,
yeah. While also being duly modest about, in this case, the effect that the running mate can have. So you know, it's hard because, you know, we call this book "The Running Mates Matter," and it lends itself to a yes or no answer. And as would be typical for academic conversations, my real answer is, well, it's complicated. You know? And so they matter, but it's going to be on the margins, and it's not really going to be through somehow convincing people to vote for the vice president.
Right.
You know, this is where the nuance comes in. It's kind of a blurry line here, but I'll try my best to point it out. It's not that you're getting people to go to the polls and say, you know, I really resent Joe Biden. I did not vote for him in the primaries. I still don't like him. But wow, I would really love for you know, Stacey Abrams to be the vice president of the United States. Or I'd really love for, Amy Klobuchar to be vice president of the United States. Some people might, think that they feel that way, but just the evidence doesn't bear that out, at least to the extent that we have evidence for some of these things. And again, Abrams might be a different case because we don't have data on African-American running mates and so on. So, yeah. But at the same time, they can shift these perceptions of the presidential candidate. They do matter in that way. So, any effect that you're going to have is going to be on the margins, but it's still a real effect. And I should throw in here, just as somewhat of an aside, there is probably something to the idea that a running mate can hurt more than help.
Mm-hmm.
You can probably do more damage through it. And I put it this way. People start with the expectations. We're predisposed to expect that whoever's going to be chosen for the vice presidency of the United States, who's going to run for that position, is going to be reasonably well qualified and reasonably likable. There's not really a lot of opportunity to greatly exceed people's expectations. Oh, wow, this person is super qualified and super likable. You know, that person probably would have run for the presidency in the first place and won the nomination.
Right, right.
I'm not saying it never happens, but man, I'd have a hard time thinking of someone who could fit that description now or in the past.
There is no, as we sometimes, the lingo of the blog is Johnny Unbeatable. Right.
Yes,
like, there is no exactly. Johnny Unbeatable out there. It's like when people point out all the flaws of the candidates, well, we should have run someone else. Well, who?
Yep.
Johnny Unbeatable. Yeah.
But if you're thinking, I like to think of it in my head as sort of on like the scale of qualified and likable, probably people's default expectation is like a 75 on the 0 to 100 scale, So it's like, there's kind of the ceiling effect on it. However, there's a lot of room to drop. There's a lot of room to disappoint people. And I think that's going to catch people's attention more than the converse. So picking someone who's, well qualified, you have a ton of people to pick from if you're Joe Biden. If you were to really kind of get cute about it and try to pick someone who's going to pick off this really targeted segment of the electorate and change this one state and so on, probably not going to deliver that effect. But if in order to do that, you've chosen someone who's not very credible or not very likable, one of those or both, there's a lot more room to really disappoint people and say, oh, wow, that catches my attention. I can't believe he made a choice like that. Maybe Joe Biden isn't who I think he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. So we've gone on for quite a while. I think we should probably bring this to a close, but I'll just close with like one final question. You've now, you've got two books and like three or four articles, one of them a follow-up on the first book. Is this project tapped out, or do you see any kind of new directions you'd like to take the research?
There'll always be new vice presidential candidacies, and they'll have their own unique elements. So yeah. I would certainly anticipate. I'm eager to, once we find out who the running mate is, and whatever questions that might bring up, especially if we do get an African-American or Latina running mate or whoever it might be, that could present its own new dynamics. So I'm definitely interested in that. As for the larger project, I think Kyle and I have been building to this for over a decade. And as we get at, we kind of talk about this in the acknowledgments that, really this is finally us answering the question that we started with. Yeah, we were focused on the home state, but it was really implicit. And it was a broader question of do running mates matter in all these different ways that people talk about? Mm-hmm. So I think we really feel like we reached the point we wanted to. So I can't say, that this is like one step towards the next big part of the project or big book or whatever. So we have some ideas, but as far as any really big projects on this, not really. A lot of my research in recent years has been going more towards presidential campaign visits, and I'm planning to work on a book. I'll be starting this summer on that. So that's actually the where things are going to turn. Kyle and I have some research on minor party candidates as well. We're working on now. So, I think I haven't, we haven't said all we want to say, but I think we've especially because there will be new cases out there. But for the time being, we feel really well satisfied that this is what we've been trying to say all along, and we finally provided evidence in a unified way that just hasn't been out there in the literature. So we're really, really satisfied with that.
Great. That's so rare among kind of academic research projects to really have an endpoint, right? Say, okay, no, I've really done it. And yes, history marches on, we'll have more data, but you know, basically, it's in large ways a function of the relatively, you know, specific nature of the research project. But
yeah,
I've certainly never felt that way when finishing an article or a book. I'm like, oh, done with that subject. I figured it out. I said all I need to say. Like that.
And that might change. I think when we wrote the first book, we kind of before we fully processed it, we had this feeling like, okay, then, you know, we got to it. And then like, as it was coming out, we started getting these questions, actually, a lot of, you know, media conversations, things like that. Oh, do they matter in these ways too? And we kind of had to go to like, well, I don't know. We've done some really preliminary research, but we don't know. So it just brought up those questions. So who knows? This might, I might say what I just said and then find, if you ask me a year later, I say, oh, actually,
here's the one
brought this up and now we're wondering this. So
yeah,
who knows?
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, thanks for your time and thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure. This is, again, we can't talk in the hallways like this these days, but it's good to have a nice long conversation this way.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.